Chapter 14, Journey of Transformation. First, live a compassionate life, then you will know. Buddha. By having reverence for life, we enter into a spiritual relation with the world. Albert Schweitzer. There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the roots. Henry Thoreau Walden. The jeweled web of journeys. How can we best contribute to our culture's awakening and evolution to greater intelligence, compassion, peace, and fulfillment? We each have a unique piece of the puzzle to contribute, which emerges out of responding to the dreams, aspirations, and yearnings in our heart that develop through the course of our particular life journey. When we develop a sense of the wonder and potential of our unique life, we feel the same toward others. This emerges as respect and understanding for them and the urge to cooperate with and support them. This is a basic expression of our innate sanity. Because we value our life, we value the lives of others and naturally yearn to live to benefit them. If we feel our life to be a distasteful burden, we will most likely have a low opinion of the worth of the lives of others. We can reverse this by switching to a more compassionate diet and by contemplating and affirming the preciousness of our life, of all life. The urge of compassion will grow as we cultivate our sense of connectedness with everything. As we become freer and more grateful for our life, we naturally become a force for positive change in the world. To better understand the unique nature and power of our journey, it may be helpful to examine our lives in order to discover the hidden seeds from our past that are now pushing, like living green shoots, into our consciousness. Small, unrecognized seeds, when recognized and honored, can grow into strong and beautiful trees in the garden of our lives. I offer this chapter as a modest example of this process and encourage everyone to look into the soil of their own garden for the hidden seeds that may already be sprouting into beautiful and beneficent plants. In particular, by further discovering the seeds of veganism within us, we can nurture them and develop our understanding of our unique contribution to the healing of our world. We will touch many, for our journeys are all connected. In the Avatamsaka tradition of Mahayana Buddhism, there is a central teaching metaphor that is referred to as the teaching of the jeweled web. It is not only a teaching, but also an image to be meditated upon for greater insight into the truth of being. The universe is likened to an infinite web, and at every node of this vast web there is a jewel. Every dharma in the universe, every being, thing, or event, is one of these jewels. Thus, every being, thing, and event is connected to every other being, thing, and event throughout infinite space and time. Not only that, but if we look deeply into any one jewel in this vast web, we can see reflected in this jewel all of the other jewels in the cosmic net. Each and every individual dharma contains all others, and if we truly know one, we know all of them. The ancient teaching that emerges from and sustains this metaphor of the jeweled web is known as the teaching of the conditioned arising and mutual interpenetration and interdependence of all phenomena. Everything is dependent upon everything else, nothing is ever separate, and each particle contains the entire universe. We are all profoundly and radically related. We can see that our stories and journeys are also intimately interconnected, and that each journey, though unique, miraculously contains all the other journeys of all beings. We all learn from each other, though at the deepest levels we see that there are, ultimately, no others. We all share the same source, and the walls that we build to separate us are illusory. As we evolve and as the imaginary walls dissolve, compassion and freedom increase along with our deepening understanding of the interbeing of all life. This teaching of the profound interconnectedness of all life is not unique to Buddhism, but has been intuited for centuries by people from many traditions and cultures. A universal teaching that is inseparable from this understanding of interbeing is mindfulness, cultivating our ability to be fully present in our actions and to see the connections between our actions and their effects. Mindfulness brings freedom and insight by increasing our awareness. The more aware and mindful we are, the more free we become. In terms of food, in order to understand the rippling web of suffering that we as a culture create, perpetuate, and magnify through our daily sacred acts of eating, and the web of interconnection in which freedom, compassion, and love can grow and illuminate our world, we must go on a journey. A journey undertaken with mindfulness is a pilgrimage because it has a spiritual purpose: to increase our awareness and our ability to love and understand. Our culture is in the halting first steps of a journey of transformation in which we all participate and to which we all contribute by our own journeys. It necessarily unfolds in time, but the gestalt it points to is our living, breathing situation, our shared life today. It is our pilgrimage together, and for this, mindfulness is essential. Seeds of Inspiration. My journey toward questioning the pervasive abuse of animals for food began in a seemingly unlikely way, for I was born and raised in a family and neighborhood with no interest in plant-based eating at all. Consequently, for the first 22 years of my life, I, like most Americans, ate large quantities of animal flesh, eggs, and dairy products. I did, however, encounter seeds of inspiration that lay dormant at first, but later began to sprout vigorously. Though these seeds pertain to one unique journey, they may illumine half-hidden seeds that are sending forth new shoots of understanding for others. For me, one seed was being born and raised in the town of Concord, Massachusetts, the home of two of the so-called revolutions that the United States has experienced: the political revolution of the 1760s and 70s, and the literary revolution of the 1840s and 50s. Being born and raised in Concord gave me a sense of intimate connectedness with these two revolutions and of being their descendant, with an urge to question them, understand what motivated them, and carry them on myself. I believe these two revolutions have contributed to the emerging vegan revolution, which is a cultural revolution of profound significance that can heal our culture at the deepest level. The political revolution culminated in the beginning of the Revolutionary War at the Old North Bridge in Concord on April 19, 1775. The farmers and villagers living in Concord and the other towns surrounding Boston provided some of the strongest resistance to British imperialist rule and fought the unjust economic domination imposed by the British East India Company and other British multinational corporate forces that were being militarily and politically supported and legitimized by the British government at that time. This 18th century revolution led eventually to independence from the British Empire and birthed the epic American experiment in democracy, equality,
cultural pluralism, and individual freedom that continues to attract and inspire people all over the world. It is remarkable that the literary and philosophical revolution of the following century was also based in Concord. It sprang from the lives and writings of the American transcendentalists living there: Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Bronson Alcott, Louisa May Alcott, William Ellery Channing, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and many others like Walt Whitman, who were inspired by the transcendentalists and journeyed to visit them. We recognize these leading thinkers today for the deep questioning of traditional values that they introduced and for the artistic, literary, and spiritual inspiration they provided. Emerson's philosophical writings like Nature, his oratorial contributions like the Harvard Divinity School Address, and his poetry, which pioneered bringing Eastern philosophical ideas for the first time to the United States, made him something of a living legend, a magnet that attracted writers and thinkers from many directions and whose influence is still strongly alive today, urging respect and love for nature, self-exploration, and appreciation of the essentially spiritual nature of all manifestation. He emphasized that true wisdom transcends materialistic knowledge, and that the natural world is also a manifestation of the divine. Whitman wrote, quote, "I was simmering, simmering. Emerson brought me to a boil," end quote. Thoreau was strongly influenced by Emerson and vice versa, and in some ways has eclipsed his teacher and mentor in influence. His radical experiment to live in solitude at Concord's Walden Pond and to, quote, "suck out the marrow of life" continues to inspire spiritual seekers and, in a powerful way, pioneered the planting of introspective inner listening in the excessively extroverted American cultural soil. The Concord philosophers saw clearly that an internal element was missing from their culture, which was overly focused on external conquest and success. Thoreau had the largest library of books on Eastern philosophy in the United States at that time, and his book Civil Disobedience, still one of the primary source documents of nonviolent resistance and an enduring revelation of the power and responsibility of individuals to actively oppose unjust governmental policies, deeply influenced Tolstoy, Gandhi, King, and the lives of countless people. Bronson Alcott's radically progressive ideas regarding the education of children are being rediscovered and finally appreciated today. He was an ethical vegetarian and a prime moving force behind the formation of Fruitlands, an unlikely experiment in vegetarian community living in the countryside outside Concord. The Concord Transcendentalists were the first Americans to explore and weave into Western thought many of the noble and subtle ideas from Taoist, Buddhist, Jain, and Vedantist writings, and to build progressive bridges that included honoring nature, emphasizing the essential goodness and vast potential of human nature, and exploring lifestyles of nonviolence, simplicity, and inner contemplation. The American roots of deeply questioning food and developing the philosophical foundation for a more compassionate relationship with animals can be traced to the progressive writers clustered around Emerson in Concord in the mid-19th century. Thoreau wrote, quote, "I have no doubt that it is a part of the destiny of the human race and its gradual improvement to leave off eating animals as surely as the savage tribes have left off eating each other when they came into contact with the more civilized," end quote. Emerson's, quote, "You have just dined, and however scrupulously the slaughterhouse is concealed in the graceful distance of miles, there is complicity," end quote, shows the esteemed Concord sage's ability to make the connections that elude most. Bronson Alcott's daughter, Louisa May, wrote, quote, "Vegetable diet and sweet repose, animal food and nightmare. Pluck your body from the orchard, do not snatch it from the shambles, slaughterhouse. Without flesh diet, there could be no blood-shedding war," end quote. She makes explicit the connection between the violence inherent in eating animals, nightmares, and the nightmare of human violence turned against ourselves. Perhaps as a child wandering through the forests and along the streets of Concord and along the shore of Walden Pond, where I learned to swim, I sensed the noble and courageous thoughts of these spiritual pioneers. Though there seemed to be little in the outer world to encourage questioning the cruel food customs I was born into, perhaps the thoughts and feelings of these luminaries filtered through the inner worlds that I was exploring along with the outer world. I am sure that all of us have such memories of seed experiences, perhaps only dimly recognized, that are now unfolding in consciousness. We learn from each other and plant seeds in each other. Through examples, actions, words, expressions, writings, and gestures, we touch each other, sometimes deeply. As sensitive children, we can be blessed or wounded enormously. Several other seeds stand out in shaping my journey. One was growing up with a noble and gentle German shepherd. Our family got Bismarck as a puppy when I, the oldest of three children, was about a year old. He was my loyal friend until he passed away in my teens, which was a sad loss for our entire family. He always accompanied us on our frequent camping and hiking expeditions in the mountains of New Hampshire and Vermont. My parents disliked animal cruelty and killing, so we never included hunting or fishing in our regular outings into nature. Besides instilling in me a loving appreciation for the outdoors from an early age, my father taught me to play the piano and to explore the mysterious power of music to relax, uplift, and express deep feelings. He was a semi-professional pianist, and his love for music and harmony was an abiding inspiration. I will always remember how he taught my brother and me to sing in harmony up in the mountains. Being born into a newspaper family was another significant seed in my life journey. Around the time I was born, my parents bought a tiny weekly newspaper in the Concord area. I grew up in the midst of a swirling world of linotype machines and printing presses, promotions, weekly deadlines, and an unending parade of local politicians and merchants. My father's stream of editorials and stories, my mother's paintings and graphics, and the constant growth of the little newspaper were the hub of our family's life. The newspaper, The Beacon, thrived and expanded, and my father was able to purchase or start newspapers in other towns in the Concord area as well. By the time I reached high school, we had a chain of 13 newspapers with several hundred employees housed in a large new building in the neighboring town of Acton. I saw firsthand the fabled power of the press and how senators, congressional representatives, and local politicians all came to my father hoping for his backing, and how the local merchants required advertising. I saw also how our newspaper needed the merchants as well and would zealously defend them. Through our immediate involvement in the town meetings, issues, and local politics, I felt as though I had an insider's view on all that was happening in our community. Another seed was the sense pervading our lives that we were true Americans. My father was patriotic in the extreme and loved to quote Patrick Henry and fly the flag. My mother's relatives came over as pilgrims on the Mayflower in 1620, and our Tuttle ancestors came from England as Puritans on the Planter in 1630. Every April 19th, when thousands of people gathered at the Old North Bridge in Concord to celebrate and reenact, quote, the shot heard round the world, end quote, the beginning of the Revolutionary War in Concord, my father dressed as one of the Minutemen and marched the 6 miles from Acton to Concord, retracing the original line of march and reenacting the historic battle. Growing up conscious of being descended from the Pilgrims and Founding Fathers, I felt especially connected to the American dream. I relished and valued the ideals that the United States is supposed to stand for and the idea of revolution. The Pilgrims and Puritans, like Emerson and Thoreau, valued simplicity, community, and viewing life essentially as a spiritual quest. When these seeds began to sprout, they transformed my view as I began to see life more as a pilgrimage and to focus less on acquiring and competing and more on the purpose of the pilgrimage. I also began to see that such a view would be considered somewhat subversive. The Organic Dairy at Camp Challenge. Another seed experience from my childhood that stands out vividly, and that I am grateful for having helped awaken my heart, is witnessing the killing of a cow on an idyllic Vermont dairy farm. I was about 12 years old and attending a summer camp in the Green Mountains called Camp Challenge. The philosophy and practice of the camp was to challenge boys in positive ways, and I have many memories of these challenges. Difficult whitewater canoe expeditions, five-day forays in the steep mountains, living outdoors for weeks at a time and cooking all our meals on campfires, washing in the icy brook, and even doing a two-day solo in the wilderness equipped with only 3 matches, a knife, and a hook and fish line. The camp was affiliated with an organic farm in the valley below us where we would sometimes work baling or weeding. At one point, all of us boys went down there and were told to catch one of the hens that roamed freely. We were shown how to put her head between 2 nails and a board on the ground and hold her with one hand while we chopped off her head with a hatchet held in the other hand. I was glad I was one of the few who made a clean cut with the first blow and watched the headless chicken, like the other unfortunate creatures, run around the barnyard spouting blood till she expired. We all learned how to dip the corpses in scalding water, pluck and eviscerate them, and we all ate chicken for many days afterward. I was a bit uncomfortable with the whole thing, but I was a well-trained omnivore, and by age 12 I knew I had to be tough and that certain animals were put here for humans to eat. We had to eat them or we would be unhealthy. A few weeks later, we all went down to the farm again. There were horses and cows and fields of beans and wheat under a beautiful blue sky, and we were brought to the barn where a cow was standing alone in the middle of the wooden floor. She was one of the dairy cows, and Tom, the owner, director of the camp and the farm, and a handsome Dartmouth-educated outdoorsman we all admired enormously, informed us that she could not give enough milk and we would therefore be using her for meat. He held a rifle in his hand and pointed to a precise spot on her head where the bullet would have to hit so that she would fall. He asked if one of the older boys would like to try making the shot. One boy raised his hand, took the rifle, aimed, and fired a bullet into her head at point-blank range while we all stood and watched. The cow jolted but continued standing. Tom gave the rifle to another of the older boys who wanted to try, and he also fired a bullet into her head. Again, she jolted upon the impact, but continued to stand there, blinking. Then Tom took the rifle, aimed, and fired. I was astounded as the cow instantly crashed to the floor, feces and urine gushing from her rear near where I stood. Tom immediately grabbed a long knife, jumped across her prostrate body, and with a great, strong stroke, cut her head almost completely off. I was amazed at how far the blood shot out of her open neck, propelled by her still beating heart, long red liquid arcs flying through the air and splattering all around us as her body convulsed on the blood-soaked floor. We all watched silently as she finally stopped moving and bleeding, and many of us had to wipe our blood-spattered arms and legs. While I stood in shock and horror at what I had just witnessed, Tom wiped his brow and calmly explained that the meat would be no good if her heart didn't pump the blood out of her flesh. It would be soggy and useless. We spent the next hour or so disemboweling her body, pulling out all the different organs, identifying them and holding them. I noticed how the pools of blood coagulated into large globs of red jelly on the wooden floor. Tom at one point called us over to show us a part of her anatomy he held in his hand. She apparently had something wrong with her ovaries, and he was showing us the defect, telling us that was why she had to be killed. We all finally got the large edible parts into the back of a truck to be taken to a butcher. We would eat her flesh for the rest of the month. Some of the boys took souvenirs: teats, tail, eyes, brain. The following summer, I again attended Camp Challenge, and although I enjoyed the hiking, canoeing, and outdoor living, I was a bit anxious when, a few weeks into the session, Tom again told everyone to walk down to the organic dairy farm. Again, there was a cow singled out, standing in front of the barn on that gorgeous summer day. It would be her last day, and she looked very uncomfortable. Tom said he didn't want to do it in the barn this year. We would bring her up to a flat, grassy area a few hundred yards away. We put a rope around her neck and tried to pull her along with us as we walked up the little hill. She didn't want to go and resisted strongly. The harder we pulled, the more strongly she resisted. I was surprised at her strength. There were probably 30 or so kids pulling on that rope, and we could hardly get her to move at all. Seeing we wouldn't be successful that way, Tom got a heavy chain, tied it around her neck, and attached it to the back of his four-wheel drive truck. We all rode in the back or walked along as the truck pulled her, still strongly resisting, up the hill. Then an incredible thing happened. We were getting close to the flat area, the cow still resisting with all her strength, the wheels steadily turning, when suddenly the chain snapped. The truck lurched forward, and we in the truck all fell down. The cow stood there in the road, her head at an oblique angle, looking up at us. As I saw her standing there, mute and yet expressing herself so profoundly, I wished we could just leave her alone and let her live. Still, I believed she was our food. This was her only purpose. The tension between seeing her as a being and seeing her as meat was intense. I don't remember much of what happened after that, except that we did somehow get her up to the flat spot and proceed to shoot her, bleed her, disembowel her, send her to the butcher, and eat her during the following weeks. When we did it this time, though, I wasn't shocked, because I'd seen it before. I had lost my feelings. Seeds of Understanding. For 9 more years I continued, undaunted, to eat the flesh, milk, and eggs of animals. I simply did not know one could survive without doing so, and I had never met anyone who ate a plant-based diet. When I went away to Colby College in Maine and heard of vegetarianism, something inside me was kindled, but the programming of my inherited omnivorism was still far too strong to have me question my fundamental eating habits. Then, while at Colby in 1974, my junior year, I heard of the Farm in Tennessee, a relatively newly formed spiritual community of about 800 people, mainly from San Francisco. The more I read about the farm, the more intrigued I became, and one of the things that intrigued me most about the farm was that everyone there was a vegetarian. It was a vegan community, actually, though that word was not yet in common usage, for they were vegetarian not for health reasons, but for ethical and spiritual reasons, and they ate no animal products whatsoever, not even eggs, dairy products, or honey. I had yet knowingly even to meet a vegetarian in my life at that point, but I saw in the books published by the farm pictures of happy, healthy-looking, and highly creative people living with a mission to demonstrate a more sustainable and harmonious way of living. I did my senior thesis in organizational behavior on the farm, examining the theory and practice of a community based on cooperation rather than competition, sharing rather than owning, and compassion rather than oppression. It was an eye and heart-opening project for me to study their way of living. Success was measured in terms of spiritual values rather than material values, emphasizing quality of life and service to humanity and to all life, rather than the accumulation of wealth and things. Their purpose was clearly stated, quote, "We're here to help save the world." In my last 2 years at Colby, I felt a major shift happening within me. I hungered for a deeper connection with nature and with spirituality, and began exploring meditation in both Eastern and Western spiritual traditions. One book from the late 19th century stood out, Cosmic Consciousness by R.M. Buck. In this book, which had a profound impact on me, the author introduced the idea that while most people operate with what he termed self-consciousness, an unsatisfactory state of self-preoccupation, certain people had attained what he termed cosmic consciousness. Buck maintained that this higher level of consciousness, which is marked by moral elevation, intellectual illumination, spiritual wisdom, and loss of the fear of death, is the next stage of human evolution. When I read these words, the world of careers that awaited after graduation looked like a bleak and unfulfilling distraction from the real goal of living, which had to be to reach a higher level of consciousness than the narrow pursuit of self-interest I saw around me. When I talked about these ideas with my brother, he responded with wholehearted agreement. Together, we formulated a plan of action.